First one learns Dhamma, but does not yet understand it. Then one understands it, but has not yet practiced it. One practices, but has not seen the truth of Dhamma. Then one sees the Dhamma, but one's being has not yet become Dhamma. Now, Jan, please enlighten us on this statement. I've got to be very careful with some of the translations of Ajahn Chah, because I always prefer reading in Thai first of all, because some of the translations are inaccurate. Everybody knows when you translate, it's maybe 90% of the original and 10% of the translator. That's not so bad, but sometimes it's 80% of the translator and only 20% of the original. So you have to be careful there. Yeah? But first one learns the Dhamma but does not understand it. That may be that when you go to these Dhamma schools and you learn Four Noble Truths, you can say suffering, the end of, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading to the end of suffering. You can recite it like a parrot. You don't really understand what it means. Then you understand what it means, but only just superficially. But you haven't practiced it. But when you actually practice these things, you understand what, say, suffering really is. And especially the Second Noble Truth, the cause of suffering. Every time you want something, you pray something, you meditation, you suffer. You get frustrated. But then you do Third Noble Truth meditation, just to let go. Make peace, put your cup down, and it becomes peaceful and happy. You understand the Third Noble Truth meditation, you practice the Eightfold Path. So you practice these things, and when you practice these things, you get the experience, you actually see the truth of Dhamma. And when you see the truth of Dhamma, you see, actually, this works. But then you have to make that experience. Seeing it work, that's actually the achievement of stream winning. But once you become a stream winner, you have to make sure that all those great insights and wisdom, that actually becomes part of your life. So in stream winning, you see that craving is the cause of suffering, you see that so clearly, and now you have to let go of all that craving. And that's when you become Dhamma. And that's just in Ajahn Chah's words. That's the enlightenment, full our heart. As the Buddha said, it's like the person who's done, I won't give the full simile, but it's like the person who is shipwrecked, they're in the ocean, and they can see the shore, they can see safety, that's the stream winner. You're in bobby ground in the ocean, you see, oh, there's dry land over there. You see safety, so you know which way to swim. And then you start swimming. When you start swimming, that's the one to return, you're on the way. You get so close to the shore, you don't need to swim anymore, you can actually stand up, you know, in the surf. Just like on the beach outside. You can stand out, and I don't know how many meters, I haven't been out there, but how many meters before you actually have to start swimming. And that's like you're so close to the shore, you can stand and start wading to the shore. That's the non-returner, the ankara. And when you're sitting on the shore, having a cup of tea, or a couple of having a durian, or a hamburger, or whatever you like, that means you reach safety, you're not around. Anyway, next question, what's the difference between rebirth and reincarnation? Is the process more or less the same? Yeah, it's more or less the same. But people who are pedantic are very specific. They say, well, look, rebirth is reincarnation without a soul. So if it's reincarnation, they think that some being going into another life, rather than rebirth, the continuation of a process. If you're going to be very careful with the use of speech, fine, but for most people, reincarnation is the same as rebirth. So I'll just use the words interchangeably. That was a quick answer, I'll just do one more question. How many questions can I do now before we go to more questions? Another couple. The Buddha always referred to the first jhana with these words. He enters the pond and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by a fine and sustained thought with rapture, pleasure, born of seclusion. What is meant by a fine and sustained thought? Please explain. Now this is again one of the reasons why I learnt my Buddhism in Pali. Because you say that you enter the jhana and remain in it, and you have a tea, and it says, Sawitaka, Sawichara, or Sawitaka Vichara, which means with Vitaka Vichara. That does not mean thinking, which is why that some of these translators who did these first translations, they never had experience of those deep meditations, which is why that, you know, if they had a jhana, they would have never translated with the word thought. what actually is from an experiential point of view. In that first jhana, you're experiencing bliss, very powerful bliss, and it's born of the fact your five senses have stopped. You're free of them. It's like being out of a prison. It's like the bliss you feel, but no, well, not really like it, but similar, when you've been carrying your heavy shopping bags and you put them down, you can put your feet up and rest. It's like the pleasure you've just finished work and now you're on a holiday. Well, whoopee, I don't have to go to work for a few days. It's the pleasure of something very painful and heavy being let go of. The five senses and the body. So you've got that pleasure there, but there is still a little bit of clinging left, of holding on. That is the word vichara. It's not applied, it's not sustained thought. It's a holding on, the mind holding on to that bliss. It hasn't totally let go yet. 99.9% of a little bit holding on. Because it's a little bit holding on, it makes the experience unstable. Which means the bliss tends to get less, or you feel yourself moving away from that bliss. That is just natural. You don't go that far, the bliss is so strong, it just draws you back in again. The act of drawing you back in is called the vitakka. So it's what I describe as a wobble. You've got a credible bliss there, but you're moving in and out, vitakka vichara. And the reason you're doing that is because you're not totally letting go. In the same way, when you watch the breath, you interfere with it somehow. That is actually a holding on to the breath. You don't really totally let it go. This is why it's, you know, the breath is not so peaceful. So you have the vichara, which is a holding on to that bliss, moves away, the vitakka draws back in again. That's the vitakka. The next thing which happens is you loosen up. You don't hold on tightly, you do more letting go. In fact, you do so much letting go, you almost totally let go. You've got this tiny bit left, which means you have the vichara, but it's not enough to disturb the bliss. You don't wobble anymore. It's right in there, but actually you're still holding on. That is what Sariputta described as between the first and second jhana. No more vitakka, no more moving on to the object, and you've still got some vichara and holding on. As Sariputta said, that's between the first and second jhana. To me, it's more part of second jhana than first jhana, which I think why the Buddha just lumped that in the second jhana. In the second jhana, they say you've got sampasadana, which is like confidence. You've got so much confidence in what you're doing, you totally let go. That's 100% letting go in the second jhana. Which means you don't hold on to anything anymore. Your child is gone. And that's when you get your first real stillness. That's the peak of samadhi, your stillness. And the happiness, the bliss you feel in that state is the bliss born of stillness. Totally nothing moves. And that's the first time in your existence you can remember that nothing moves anymore. You're absolutely still. And that's so incredibly powerful, peaceful and blissful. And that's the bliss of the second jhana. No movement, you can't make things move. You're not holding it, nothing's being held at all, but everything's stopped and still. By the lake, which is glassy smooth. Have you ever seen, gone into the mountains and seen these lakes and they're perfectly smooth? Not a ripple on the surface. And it's always very beautiful. This is the beauty of the mind when it's that still in the second jhana. Outside of jhana, those two words, vitakka, vichara, they do mean thinking. So words are used to mean different things in different contexts. This is why that when I learned Pali, it was Professor A.K. Water from Cambridge. He said you should never translate word by word, you should translate sentence by sentence or phrase by phrase, because he said the unit of language is a phrase, not a word. So you look at a whole phrase, what does that phrase mean? And then translate it accordingly. And the example I often give is the English idiom, in rain cats and dogs. So if you translate that into Mandarin, word by word, it would actually mean something totally stupid. You know, because it doesn't mean that cats and dogs fell out of the sky. It's just an idiom means it rained heavily. So if you translate into Mandarin, you just say it rained heavily, whatever that word is. If you do it word by word, you get into big trouble. And that's the same with Vitaka Vichara. The word cats and dogs, Vitaka Vichara, is used in one way, in one context, and in a special context of laying, cats and dogs means heavily. So that's why you have to be very careful doing translations. But that's actually what it means. Your emptiness, which you can't elaborate on mudita, why some translate as sympathetic joy and some as appreciative joy. They're both pretty much the same. You know, mudita is when somebody in this room, I announce they've just had an amazing jhana, and they say, oh, isn't that wonderful? The opposite is saying, Deb, it's really unfair. You know, this is their first retreat. And I've been coming here for years and years, I've got absolutely nothing, that really sucks. And do you know they've been SMSing and texting in their rooms, and they get jhanas, you know, they've been talking all the time, and they haven't been, you know, been sneaking food, I've seen them in the evening, and they got jhanas, that is not fair. Now that's the opposite of mudita. So you know that jealousy and that sort of negativity. The mudita is just so happy that someone else is happy. It's what we call, like, you know, the free gift of happiness. You don't have to be happy. You don't have to achieve anything. But someone else has. Wow, it's so wonderful. That in this world there's still people getting jhanas, getting enlightened. Even though it's not you. Have a lot of joy that is happy. So that's mudita. And any one of you who gets, you know, a nimitta or a jhana especially, or anything like that, when you come and tell me, I get so much joy. That is actually my paycheck for this retreat. You don't have to give me £1. Just come up and tell me you just got a jhana. And that's worth billions of £1. Simply because I get so much mudita, so much joy in knowing that you've got something beautiful. In the same way that, you know, if your kid does well at university, or they land this really great job, yeah, that's mudita. You're happy at somebody else's success. It's free joy. Actually, one of our monks, he said, that's a great way of meditating. Just right now, don't think of all the people suffering. Think of all the people who are having happiness today. All the people who have found some peace and some joy in their life. And when you think of that, it's a beautiful world. A big philosophy of free happiness. Is it true as we meditate we become more sensitive about how the people around us think and feel? Or is it just our own mind that creates that kind of thought? No, you do become more sensitive. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. You have to relate to each other. A lot of times you become so sensitive you can see someone, you know, actually just to leave them alone. Or you know when you can just start smiling at them. You become sensitive enough you don't make so much of a problem with your life relating to other people. It's amazing just how insensitive we are. We speak to people and it's not the right time to speak. When they really do need a word, we just ignore them. Dear sir, my understanding of reincarnation is from human into another human form, perhaps with animalistic attributes. Why do some Buddhist teachings teach reincarnation to burn animal or worm forms? Because that can happen. I teach that as well, so does the Buddha. You can actually go for many, many different forms of existence. I tell people who speak a lot, if you spend most of your life horizontal, you'll be reborn as one of the horizontal beings. Just crawl along the ground. So there's a sense of justice there. I sometimes, in the first years, I ask some of my disciples in Australia, you know, where would you like to be reborn? I remember this one guy said, I want to be reborn as a dog. Now, for Asians, being reborn as a dog, a dog is the lowest of the animals. So what do you want to be reborn as a dog for, I asked them. Well, they said, a dog doesn't have to go to work on a Monday morning. They can sleep around all day, they eat great food, and they get taken for a walk, they've got no stress at all. So, you know, in the West, being a dog, you know, you can actually get dog baths, you go to actually dog, you get your hair done, hairdressing as a dog, you get free medical care as a dog, you have a wonderful life as a dog, you really get pampered as a dog in the West. He said to me, so I want to be reborn as a dog. And then I told him, like, in a country like Australia, in the first weeks of life of a dog, they get taken to the vet to get spayed. When I told him that, he said, okay, I don't want to be a dog anymore. You like his sex life. So be careful what you wish for. You'd be in big trouble. But it can happen. You can go, you know, either way. But these days, it's more easy to get reborn as a human being than ever before. Why? It's because there's more vacancies in the human realm. You know, it's like a company taking on more workers. It's easier to get a job there. Or like the mining companies in Western Australia. They're crying out for workers. They can't get enough. So because there's more empty human wombs, because people are still having lots of children, and there's more people alive today than have ever died, so there's all these amazing opportunities to get reborn as a human these days. Because there's more people with tendencies. Anyway, Ajahn, have you written a guide to the Vinaya before? Are there any translations that you would recommend? Between the Vinaya and the Suttas, is there one that is considered more important than the other? It's usually, you know, the Suttas are very important. When it comes to the Vinaya, there is still a lot of debate with the Westerners about how much is really essential Vinaya, how much is the Buddhist teachings, and how much are the Buddhist teachings in the Vinaya. And it's also, the Suttas are controversial enough, but when you get to the Vinaya, bucks get very, very hot with Vinaya questions. For example, can a monk touch a woman, or a woman touch a monk? Now in Thailand, as all the Thai people here know, that is really a no-no for a monk and a woman to touch each other. So I'm in Thailand now, so please don't do that. But if you're in Australia, then I will shake your hand. Now if you're something important, Julia Gillard or something, the Prime Minister, if you put a hand out, I'll shake it. I have shaken Queen Elizabeth's hand. She put her hand out once, so I shook hers. And I did that after going to Sri Lanka for the first time. And I've got a very big reputation in Sri Lanka. So when people saw me, they actually, women, they grabbed my feet and put their head on my feet. The first time I did it, I said, you can't do that. But then I saw everyone else doing that. And I read that that's what they did in the time of the Buddha. They grabbed a monk's feet and put their head on their feet. It was a way of making respect. So you know, the Sri Lankan people here are actually from India, but there's many Sri Lankan people would affirm that that's actually what people do. And I thought, my goodness, it's allowed. And when I saw that, you know, putting your head on the feet, in the West you shake hands to greet. And when I did not shake hands with important women in government and other people, they got offended. And I realized that no, that's actually a wrong thing to do. You shake hands. Because that's a form of greeting, and that is actually allowed in the Vinaya. Other than, no, it's not allowed, but actually is allowed. Which is why sometimes you can really argue with the Vinaya. What you can't do is give a person a hug and a kiss. Now that is not allowed. Yeah. So you've got to know your limits. But you don't have to do that, except maybe if you're in France and kiss both sides of the cheeks. But I remember one of Ajahn Chah's monks, I don't mind saying, he's Ajahn Ananda, he's dead now. But he went to, he was travelling in New Zealand, and he went to this interfaith event held by the Maoris. And the Maoris' way of paying respect to you, to saying hello, is literally to rub noses. So she had this old Maori woman insisted on rubbing noses with him. He said, it doesn't matter, she was old and ugly, he said. But you don't know sometimes some of these supermodels. Who was that? What's Stuart? He married this new. It was Rachel Hunter, I think it was. Is that? She was this New Zealand girl. So, you know, amongst the rub noses with Rachel Hunter, there's going to be trouble. So that's just the expression of saying hello to someone and paying respect to them. So because I'm in Thailand, you do it the Thai way. But you know, if you're in some other country, you have to do it the other country way, within reason. So shaking hands will be okay. But you say that to people and some monks get very upset. Even though it's right there in the Vinaya, you can actually point to it and say, this is what it says. It doesn't really matter because they'll follow tradition. Rather what's in the Vinaya. So the Vinaya becomes very the source of argument and controversy. Because of that, you know, at this age of my life I try to steer clear of it. I keep my rules and that's it. So the translations are not that accurate. You know, the translations available. If you really want to see the Vinaya, just actually look at the original translations of the Vinaya done by the Pali Text Society. What is really interesting there is when you read the stories behind the rules. Because some of those stories really tell you what went on in the time of the Buddha. So people have this idea in the time of the Buddha, all the monks were all arahats in light and flying through the air. Because those are the stories of the great monks you read in some parts. But when you look at the Vinaya, there you read the stories of all the scallywags, the naughty monks and the naughty nuns. And that just shows you that these monks and nuns, human nature hasn't changed in 26 centuries. They did the same stupid things that people do these days. For example, there were these group of six monks, a group of six monks, and they were such a naughty group of monks that they're famous in monastic circles, a group of six, because they always got up to a lot of mischief. So one of the things they did, there was one monk they were really upset with. Actually, you know, they accused him of things he didn't do. So one day, they thought, how can we get our own back at this? So they saw these two goats having sex on the mountainside of the Vulture's Peak. So the group of six said, I hereby name the male goat as Dabba Malaputa. He was one of the bhikkhus. And I name this female goat as the nun, Maitreya, the nun. And then they went to the Buddha and said, look, actually we saw this, all six of us saw this. This monk, this Dabba Malaputa, was having sex with the nun. We saw this, we're not lying, it was true. And then when the Buddha, hang on, something funny going on there. What did Dabba Mala look like? Well, he had four legs at the table. That was a ghost! Well, okay, you caught us out. And so that was one of the 30 Sangaddhi Sesa rules. You can't sort of, you know, try and accuse a monk of something just by renaming other people as that monk. When the group is sick, they got up all sorts of mischief like that. One day they literally got this very young monk and they literally held him down and started tickling him. You know, just for fun. And that couldn't get his breath and actually died. And so now there's one of the monk's rules. What is it? Paticca, start Paticca 54, 55. Monks can't tickle anybody. That's one of the 227 rules. So these are really amusing because they show that monks and nuns are ordinary human beings. Yeah, the special ones, the enlightened ones, but many of them are just ordinary. And that really is fun to read. Gives you a window into life in India 26 centuries ago. It doesn't change, where do you live in the world?
Okay,
we'll do another. Is 10 o'clock too early? Can we go to 10:15? Most of you stay up late. My mind has wandered less, but is still attached to giving comments on what is happening now. Where will I stop? Okay, give the comment, shut up. Come on, I'll tell you, shut up. Or maybe you can try that Om Mani Padme Hum or Namo Buddhaya method. Just put spaces between the syllables and then eventually you get some silence. Ajahn Sumedho once wrote of the sound of silence He only described it, no instructions, and I found it useful for establishing present moment awareness. But not sure what should I do with it, whether to arise as faithful or in meditation. I think somebody asked the old Mahasi Sayadaw about Sarvasaya, that when you really get into Samadhi, you can't hear anything at all. It's great at the very beginning of meditation, but don't do it in the middle or towards the end of meditation, because it just gets you paying attention to sound. So the sound of silence, first of all, but it also, just the very word sound, would actually keep the ears turned on, so you'd never be totally able to let go of noise. So the five senses won't turn off. So there comes a time of sound of silence in the beginning, but after there's no sound at all. Not silence, not noise, nothing. So it has to turn off the healing. Beginning okay, in the middle towards the end, let it go. Okay, so those are the questions. Thank you for enduring all these questions. And remember, if you want to do more meditation, please less questions. So maybe can I make the rule only one question per person per day? And by a question I don't mean part A, part B, part C, part D, part E. Just one question per person per day. And if you have a question in the morning, you think of a better question in the afternoon, fish out your old question and throw it away to replace it. But please, only one question per person per day. Is that okay? And don't ask your friend and say, look, I've got two questions, can I buy yours? It's one per day. Okay, I'm going to do some meditation till 10:15. For half an hour, not that much. And again, I'll read the beginning, but only for a few minutes, and then I'll let you go. So again, you come home, closing your eyes. See if you can notice when your eyes are closed, you can see the inside of your eyelids. After a little while, it disappears. So now pay attention to the body, especially to know how you're sitting, to make sure that you're sitting comfortably. Preparation is important, so we develop the combination of mindfulness and kindness towards our body. It's a great way of relaxing. Mindfulness, first of all, it tells you how the sensation feels, and it changes. You can notice the sensation relaxing. It changes in the direction of more comfort and ease. That's called relaxing. And you should be able to connect the relaxation response with the kindness, with the letting be, which you give to that part of the body. Be mindful, be kind, relax it. So you continue building up mindfulness and kindness with your body. And soon you'll apply it to your mental world. body is relaxed.
Every breath.
Now apply mindfulness and compassion to your mental world. In breath, be kind, watching the mental world relax like your body relaxes. Breathing in peace, breathing out, let it go. And see how peaceful and still your mental world can become by letting it be. count three more breaths, in, out. At the end of the third breath, come out, the end of the patient. So those of you who want to carry on, if you wish. Those who want to do some flat out meditation, your beds await you. Have a good night, please.